Hi Catherine, thanks for joining us today. First of all, could you tell us what is a critical appraisal tool or CAT?
Yeah, a critical appraisal tool is really a checklist of points to look for when we're reading a particular research paper and checking that it's reliable, because a research paper will pretty much always have a conclusion to it. And so it might be very tempting for the sort of time poor practitioner to fast forward to the conclusion and say, okay, what's the take-home message from this particular piece of research? But the take-home message may be based possibly on flawed research. So it's quite important that we look through the research itself and identify any flaws. And the critical appraisal tool helps us to look at some of the most important points that would tell us whether the research is reliable or flawed.
Great, so let's look at this then in the context of a real world study. You suggested we use the effect of oral re-esterified omega-3 nutritional supplementation on dry eyes. What factors are important to bear in mind when appraising this kind of study?
Yeah, well, this is a randomised controlled study. When something describes itself as a randomised controlled study, it's really important to make sure it is properly randomised and it's properly controlled. So it might be described as such, and you might think that's what it is, and it may well be, but it's important to look for those particular factors.
How would you go about applying a CAT to this example study?
Yeah, okay, so I've used a critical appraisal tool that's provided by the Critical Appraisal Skills Programme, or CASP. The reason I've used that is because CASP provide on their website, free of charge, a number of CATs or checklists which apply to different types of study design. And so I've picked out the one that applies to a randomised controlled study, of course. And so I'll work through some of the questions that they provide in that particular CAT. We'd want to make sure that the study has been based on a clearly focused question. And that's because the question needs to be answerable. And it might seem silly to think that a question could not be answerable. But if we had a question, for example, like, do these dietary supplements work? The next question would be, what do you mean by work? You know, what's the outcome that you're looking for? So we're looking for particularly clear points about what the question is asking. And when we look through this at the end of the introduction, in fact, the authors have provided a clearly focused question that specifies the intervention that they've used, the supplement they've used, and it specifies the outcomes. So for example, things like tear breakup time and the symptoms. Secondly, this is a randomised study, so we'd want to know how the randomisation was done. It could be in a randomised study, it could be that random numbers, for example, might be generated and each individual participant is allocated a certain number. You're the first, you go into that group, you're the second, you go into that group. But what we would like to know is whether not just random numbers were generated, but also how was that allocation done? Was there some human who might be one of the researchers placed to give people these different numbers? And we're not really told how the people were allocated to groups once the numbers were generated. So we're not entirely sure whether randomization was quite correctly done, quite properly done, because we're not told about the allocation. Another factor we'd really want to look at is masking or blinding, which is the question of whether the researchers and or the participants were unaware, they should be unaware, of which group they've been placed in. Are they unaware of whether each participant is taking a true intervention or a placebo in this case? In this particular study, we are told that it was a double masked study, meaning that both the participants and the researchers were unaware. We're also told that the supplements and the placebo were identical or appeared identical. We're not told whether they smelt identical, and it seems because this is omega-3, it's possible that there was a fishy smell in one of them. As long as they did smell identical, then it's unlikely that there would have been a lack of masking. So we can be reasonably confident that masking was effective. It would also be very important in a study like this that the two groups of participants, those having the intervention and those with the placebo, were similar in a number of ways, or every way really, at the start of the study. And since it's randomised, it should be the case that if we have a sufficiently large sample, it should be the case that there's a random mix in both of these groups. But actually, we do find that the blood levels of omega-3, when we look in the results, were different in the two groups. They're actually lower in the group taking the supplement. That might mean perhaps that that group would be more likely to respond to the supplement. So the two really should be similar at baseline. So that starts to raise a little question for us, and that's one of the important points that we have to look for. Another important factor in any study really is the size of any effect. So we're looking for an effect of a particular intervention. We might be told that it's statistically significant, and that's important, but it's also equally important to consider whether it's clinically significant. So is it meaningful when the practitioner is thinking about applying this? And indeed, there are a couple of measures that have been used here that the practitioner would understand very well. So one of them is the tear breakup time. So we can have a look at that and see, in fact, that it does look quite clinically meaningful when we look at these numbers. We can also look at the subject's or the participant's symptom score. So the participants have sort of subjectively rated their own symptoms, and they do rate them as being lower. So they had less severe symptoms of dry eye when they took the intervention than when they took the placebo. So the size of the effect is important. It's also similarly important to look at the range, so not just the average size of the effect, but also the range. So if there's a very wide range, it could be that some of these participants have responded in one way, some of them responded very, very differently. So our patient who's sitting in our chair in the practice could be at any point in this range. So if we have for example, we have pictures here, we have figures showing error bars. For the practitioner, again, considering the patient sitting in their chair, an important question is whether this particular result is likely to be relevant and apply to the patient they've got in mind. If the particular piece of research applies to a specific population, so perhaps a certain ethnicity or people in a certain geographic location, people in a certain socioeconomic group or a certain gender, then that really makes the result less likely to apply widely to everybody. In this particular case, it applies to people with dry eye, and most of the participants are female, but there's not a particular focus on any one group. So it's likely to apply to the patient who has dry eye. Another factor to consider is whether there's a possible conflict of interest. So in some cases, it may be that the study has been funded by an organisation that actually makes the intervention. Of course, that would be a potential conflict of interest. In fact, in this particular example, most of the authors here did receive compensation from a company that does make omega-3 based dietary supplements for eye health. So potentially there's some conflict of interest here. And of course, that doesn't mean that it's biased by a conflict of interest, but it means that we just have to bear that in mind when we're reading and thinking about the study as a possible clinical application.
Well, that's a great overview of how to use the CAT. Another question there would be, there are a number of different CATs that could be used for any study. How do you decide the most appropriate CAT to use? How do you select appropriately?
Well, there's many, many different types of critical appraisal tool available freely on the internet. So if we search for those, we'll find many, many different types. The most important thing is the study design. So this particular one, as we mentioned, was a randomized controlled study. So that would need a particular set of questions. And as I mentioned, things like randomization, masking, the type of control, that kind of thing is all very important. If we had a review, perhaps a review or a systematic review that we were appraising, we'd need different questions entirely. If we had an observational study, we'd again need different types of questions. So the study design is an important consideration, and there are some critical appraisal tools that are available targeted to particular study designs. It's also important to have a read through the questions before you start trying to apply it, to make sure the questions actually make sense to you as a user of the critical appraisal tool, because if it doesn't, if you can't understand, of course, what the question is saying, or you can't see where you would look for the answer to that question in the paper, then it's not going to be meaningful and helpful to you as an appraisal tool.
Great. So just to summarise, what are the benefits then of using CATs and checklists, and what kind of pitfalls can they help us to avoid?
I would say the main benefit from my point of view is that it saves time. So one of the biggest sort of barriers to practitioners using research evidence is time, just having the time to find it, having the time to appraise it, as we've talked about with this critical appraisal tool. So time saving, because it allows us to focus quite quickly on particular points that we can look for in the paper. Also, another big benefit is helping the practitioner to get used to what kinds of questions to ask, because eventually perhaps we won't need to use, the individual practitioner might not need to use a tool at all, because all of these questions are embedded in their mind, you know. And it is the case, I mean, research has shown that practitioners make use of, for example, continuing education information as a basis for their practice. So of course, practitioners are going to continuing education events where they might hear a talk by somebody, and it's important that they have these kinds of questions in their mind. They won't always have a critical appraisal tool in front of them. So using a critical appraisal tool saves time, but it also helps the practitioner to know what kinds of questions to ask habitually when being presented with research evidence.
So to follow this up, what are some of the limitations of the CATS and checklists?
One limitation would be that a critical appraisal tool draws our attention to particular points. And so there is some danger that once you've satisfied yourself that for all of those points, the paper doesn't demonstrate any flaws or any potential bias, then you might be perfectly happy that it's not biased and it's reliable. But in fact, there may be some other significant flaws that the CAT doesn't draw our attention to. And so it's quite important that the practitioner has the skills and the awareness of those other potential factors so that they can read through the paper and check for those as well. And of course, that takes a little bit more time. But I think with practice, it is possible to have a reasonably rapid look through a research publication and see what other factors there might be in that particular paper. Another limitation potentially is that some critical appraisal tools use scoring systems so that, for example, every time you answer yes to a particular question, such as was it randomised appropriately, yes, you get 1 point, no, you get maybe minus 1 point or zero, then you end up with a score at the end. A potential limitation there with that system is that not all of the questions on a critical appraisal tool are necessarily equally important, so they're not all necessarily worth the same point. And so I think it's quite nice to use a critical appraisal tool that, for me, that doesn't use scoring, that's my view, and to get a more qualitative idea rather than a quantitative idea of whether this is a good, reliable piece of research.